Blog Talk Radio.
You have made it to Stu and the Nun, an online radio show that looks to inform, educate, and hopefully make you laugh. Stu and the Nun is a show focused on national security, policy, politics, and selfless service. We do this by not only interviewing guests, but also sharing our perspectives and asking you, the listener, to interact with us on our show chat room, via our Facebook page, and on Twitter.
Good evening, everybody. You've made it to Stu and the Nun. I am the Nun, and we are live on the devil known as Block Talk Radio. My main man, my brother from another motherland, my baldness compadre, Troy, are you there, my brother, the Stu?
I am there, my friend. Good to hear your voice. Good to talk to you, and good to be able to talk to everybody again on this Tuesday night at 2000 hours Eastern, also known as 8 p.m., here on the first day, working our way back to longer days now that winter solstice has passed us. I think we gained a half a second tonight.
A whole half second. And it really changed the dynamic in my day. I found
you didn't
myself
know what to do with
like,
yourself, did you?
Yeah. I was like, we're only a couple days away from Christmas, so I'll go ahead and throw a wild number out there, like two or three, mainly three, depending on what day you start the celebrations. But I wore shorts today, and I rode my motorcycle today. Not at the same time. I wear pants when I ride. But, you know, it was mid-70s. On Monday, my trainer and I worked out in the great outdoors, and I, like, was hot and concerned about, like, whether or not I put on enough lotion. So it's, like, not Christmas time, not feeling the coldness. I'm missing the winter, but not that much.
Well, you know, I'm in the up north here. I'm in a place, been known for a little bit of snow here and there. I live right near Buffalo, New York. And I think today it was 51 degrees. And foggy. Yeah. Yesterday was the same. And I think they're calling for 58 or 59, maybe 60 on Christmas. Yeah, we don't know what's going on, but here's one thing
it's
I predict.
The Nino.
The Nino, depending on who you ask, right? So last year we had this blistering cold. You know, Buffalo got hit with this crazy 8 foot of snow in 24 hours storm in November. It blew every record away to get so much snow so fast. And we had some really cold. There was one time last year, I think, if I remember right, like all 50 states had snow on the ground, right? All that crazy stuff. And the folks that are very pro-climate change, or not pro, but pro that climate change is an issue, we're saying, you know, all the people that were saying, you know, don't really believe that this whole climate change is as big as it is, we're saying, see, climate change isn't that bad. Look how much cold there is. Look how much snow there is. And all the pro-climate change people were going, no, all this coldness, all this snow is caused by climate change. It's caused by the earth warming up, which made everyone kind of tilt their head like a dog and raise your ears up and go, okay. So that was last year. So now this year we got all this warmth. We have most of the country will not see a white Christmas, and I'm waiting. It probably has already happened. I haven't seen it in the news, but I bet all those pro-climate change people are again saying, see, this is all because of climate change. It's warm because of climate change, just like last year was cold because of climate change. So, you know, I don't know. But right now we're enjoying it. I can tell you that.
I mean, you might as well get out a towel, put a little bit of water on it, clean them golf clubs up, stretch out, and get ready to tee it up and let it tee her high and let her fly like Santa does, but do it on a golf course.
Yeah, I got a buddy of mine I talked to today. He'd already winterized and put away his four-wheelers, and he said his wife was like, let's get the four-wheelers out this weekend and go riding. It's like he had snow machines ready, sleds, and as in the lower 48, call them snowmobiles, but up north in Great Alaska and Canada, I think, too, we call them snow machines. And he had those ready to go.
They're sleds, man.
Or sleds,
yeah.
Too, yeah. Ready to go, had the four-wheelers put away, and now he's got to, like, pull the four-wheelers out from the back of the garage, and they're going to go riding this way. It's crazy. But you know what? As we know here in the western New York area, that's all about to change. Because when the Lake Erie doesn't freeze over, we get this little thing called lake effect snow. That's what everyone always sees on the news. And as the lake is 47 degrees the other day, once that temperature drops and that wind blows across it, we are going to get hammered like nobody's business. That is for sure.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what might happen to me on Christmas. We're talking about snow, not drinking. Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
I'm hosting the in-laws, you know, for Christmas, so I imagine I'll probably be consuming. Speaking of consuming, I know you can't consume too much tonight because you're doing a great thing for America, and that's you're promoting the health and welfare of the what I think is one of the greatest sports and community complements that we have in North America and a lot of other places in the world, and that's hockey tonight. Pretty excited that Hunter's team is doing so well. Glad that you're able to make some, and excited that you're getting some time with the Blades, and hopefully your channels aren't too deep, and you can get out there and teach that wild-haired young man like what it's really like to deal with some boards.
Yeah, we've been working that, and we're going to be working heavy. I doubt many of my players are listening right now, but we'll be working heavy tonight on our breakout drills. They need to get back to those basics. They kind of forgot that in the last couple of games. So we're going to be working that and working some of our screening drills in front of the other goalie. You know, some of those good things. I'm sure you can be very familiar with a lot of that. So,
I am. And, you know, like speaking of breakout drills, you know, we had the Poop, which is our political commentary offshoot show that we have co-branded with the great organization Ranger Up as part of their Unapologetically American site, unapologeticallyamerican.com, where we talk about political opinions and observations and personalities. We aired that this week, and it's got some great reviews. We're pretty excited about that. And, you know, I don't want to have to say I told you so because I wasn't the one that said it, but you know, we started calling for people to make the drop, and it looks like some people have. But we'll get into that later in the show. We have an amazing guest tonight. Super excited. I've been a fan for a couple of years. In our old show, he was a guest, and so it's exciting to bring him back. So I'll let you have the honors, my brother, in introducing your good friend.
I sure will. Thank you very much. So, yeah, joining us tonight on episode 19 here with Stu and the Nun. He's a first time on this show with us. My good friend, he's an author, he's a filmmaker, he's a troublemaker, and he's a trash can. My good buddy Marine, Mike Scotty. What's up, Mike?
What is going on, my brothers? How are you doing?
Good. Not too many people know your nickname. I don't know if that's a super secret thing, only a special club do, but you are the trash can. So
I am definitely a trash can.
Hey, welcome to the show with me and Toby. Glad to have you here on Stu and the Nun, and ready for you to take a wild ride with us tonight. You ready to get this going?
I am, and I am honored I'm honored to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we are too. Well, go ahead.
When we say wild ride, I mean it's figurative, not literal, because it's a call-in show. So unfortunately, if it was live, like, where you were in studio, we'd feel compelled to, like, take you on a wild ride. But we're just going to have to do something.
Well,
if it was in studio,
I would have shown up with a 12-pack.
If it was in studio, I would have definitely shown up with a 12-pack.
Actually, probably a case, because the 12-pack would be for me.
Yeah, I was going to go ahead and say you might get laughed at if you only show up with 12. You know,
yeah, we'd have to make
only four a piece.
We'd have to make Marine jokes then. We really would. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you'd force our hand there, my man. You'd force our hand.
But no, so yeah, it's good to have you. And you know, Wild Ride is something that actually, Mike, you and I have done a time or two. Definitely one time. We may talk about that here a little bit later. But it no, good to have you. So Mike, you're a former Marine. You've been to Iraq. You've been both Iraq and Afghanistan, both on the initial incursions into both those countries. You've been very involved both during your time in service and post time in service. You are an author. You are a filmmaker. I feel like I'm going into a. I feel like I'm going into a. Heck, what is that song? Who is a Steve Miller song here? About to bust an author, filmmaker.
Yeah.
I love. But
he's a midnight
Joker. Yeah,
I'm a Joker and a midnight trash can.
Yeah, there you go.
But you know, you're right. We'll talk about that a little bit. You've written another book you're working on right now. You've been all over the press. You've talked to folks. You're a speaker. So I mean, man, you've come a long way from those opening scenes in Severe Clear as you climb up over your bed with a pro mask on, talking to the camera, doing some self video, wouldn't you say?
I think so. That was a long time ago, and I think I'm just as immature now as I was then, but I've just done more stuff. I don't know. I'm just a little older. But, no, it's been good, man. I mean, it's been good to be able to share. You know, my experiences aren't anything special, and as anybody who serves in the military or, you know, on a police force or in a fire company, you know, if your toes are cold, everybody else's toes are cold, right? If you're scared, everybody else is scared, and I'm just grateful to be able to have a platform to which to share my own experiences so that others, you know, with the hope that others can connect with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The, you know, it's, you're right. You have, you know, you may be the same guy. You haven't changed much for sure. But, I mean, you definitely have, well, everything in life, right? Experiences in life shape us. They cause us
exactly.
to make different decisions. And you've done, you know, not only, you know, the stuff you've done in combat and stuff you've done in the service, but I mean, you've kind of lived all over the world too. I mean, where's some of the places you've lived? Because I know I can never keep up with you.
let's see. I spent a lot of time in Finland. I spent a lot of time in Norway. A lot of time in England, and then in the States. Spent a lot of time in South Florida, and you know, in Miami, and then I spent a good amount of time out in L.A. Also. And
you kind of did the Hemingway thing there. I remember you hanging out in Costa Rica for a while too.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, yeah, I was in the Florida Keys for a while when I was writing the Blue Cascade, like the last like or the middle third, and then I went down to Costa Rica for a while, and I don't know. I'm just I'm really lucky in that I don't have a lot of like obligations for things that just allow. I mean, in this day and age, I mean, between Airbnb and like cheap airlines. You can live and travel like very cheaply, and sometimes it's even cheaper living other places than it would be to live in America. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, you don't have any. Let me just clarify. You don't have any obligations that you know about.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Between Airbnb and some hostel in Croatia and some, you know, and whoever knows where else you'll be, you know, and Uber and everything else, man, you can just kind of float like a butterfly.
Exactly. And also, I'm a drug mule. I don't know if you guys knew that.
That's how I fund it. So. You're a small guy. Not sure where you hide it. Not sure where you want to talk about it.
Troy, this is exactly why we have to have the disclaimer at the beginning of the show, in case people like confess felonies. Oh man,
yeah.
Awkward.
I guess we should. We need to get that made. We haven't made it yet. This is a motivation to.
Actually, you know,
no,
the thing
probably.
I'm too terrified of prison to be a drug mule. I would be like,
yeah,
the, you ever see those shows that like locked up abroad, where like the guys in the reenactment, like the guys going through the thing and start sweating? That would totally be me. Totally.
Yeah, you'd be you'd have somebody you'd be taken care of in prison. That's for sure. You're a smart guy.
That's
you
like,
know, one
like
of the,
two biggest
the
fears in life are sharks and prison. The two biggest fears.
One of the things that always cracks me up when I fly international and you know you're sitting there in your seat and you're selecting like what you want to watch. Like Nat Geo Locked Up Abroad is always available to watch. I think like they deliberately play that like as a warning.
Being convicted.
It's like you never see the show anywhere else, but like you get on an international flight, it's like, this is what happens if you go to Belize and you try and do some black talk and you bring it home. You're gonna end up in the starring in the film Broken Palace.
Yeah. And that's not about that's not about Miss Columbia of the universe pageant, is it? Broken Palace. It's a totally different stuff.
No, man, that poor thing. That poor thing.
But hey, Mike. So I mean, some people, you wrote the book. I want to kind of, so you Severe Clear, which is a very, very awesome, a film, documentary film you made. It was a lot of self footage. Just a real quick summary of that. I want to kind of recap on that real quick for our listeners, because it was a documentary kind of thing. You didn't start it out for that, right? You didn't. For those that haven't seen it, I mean, and I hope we'll go out and see it. That's not, I mean, you didn't have a camera with you, do all that thinking, hey, I'm going to make a documentary when I go to war here.
No. So that, what happened was I had, really back it up a second. My mom, when I graduated from OCS in the Marines, my mom had a video camera there. There was only like 2 seconds of footage at the end and it was up her knee. And she was like, oh, I think I messed up. And I was like, well, so that memory's gone, and that kind of was like, well, these are the good old days, right? And maybe I need to buy a video camera to start just recording this stuff, everything that's happening, whether it's following schools or showing up to the Fleet Marine Force, and then we went on deployment, pre 9/11, we left in August of 2001, and we're supposed to do a pump, right? Go hit Thailand, go hit the Seychelles, go hit Kenya. Get all these really, Australia, and then I was going to get out and go to grad school, and it was, so I was like, I'm just going to film this stuff. I mean, this is awesome stuff, and ended up, obviously, a couple of weeks later, ended up going into Afghanistan on the CH-53s and brought that small video camera with me, and obviously was tactically safe about it. I wasn't an idiot, and I talked to the JAG officer, the lawyer for the battalion, for the infantry battalion, and we actually, together, we went through the UCMJ code and saw that it was legal to bring personal photographic devices in. Talked to my battalion commander.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I ended up just shooting footage because I'm like, well, I guess this is our war, and why not shoot it if I can do it in a safe way? And we were in the defense at that point, so in Afghanistan. So I was just in the fighting hole and. As an artillery forward observer, I could use the camera, and as long as I focused outward on the enemy and actually used the zoom on a camera a bunch of times. So that was that. It was never, planned to be a documentary. And then when we, pretty obviously we were going to go to Iraq, I said, well, why don't we get a couple of cameras for different, people in the battalion, and then we could just all pool our footage together, and we could show it to our grandkids. It'll be cool to have that. And that's what we did. And I had never, I never thought about making a documentary, and I probably would have done some things differently, like simple things. But I did think about using the video as notes for a book that I'd always wanted to write, a memoir, showing my experiences, because I read so many of them when I was growing up, about guys from Vietnam, Korea, World War II, World War I, and it was really a way to quickly record things and not have to worry about jotting down notes. And when I came back, I realized that, the footage was a hell of a lot more powerful for a lot of people than me writing a book specifically about the war. And, people's eyes lit up. And it was just kind of through a couple of serendipitous moments and turns here and there that footage ended up in the hands of a production company who just took it the ball and ran with it. So it was crazy. Crazy, crazy.
And do you think that it got their attention because it was just there wasn't like a lot of that available yet, and there wasn't a plethora of their GoPros on the battlefield because they weren't even invented, and just you didn't have that, and it just got their attention because you were one of the first ones with it?
Yeah, it was. That's absolutely it. It was 2004, and I was in a very, very, very dark time. That was my dark time. 2004, 2005 was my dark time, and. It was, one of the tapes broke, and it was it's a digital video cassette. It's called Mini DV, and it's a very unstable format. And this is before everything, you know, went to hard drives. So this is, you know, what, 12 years ago, 11 years ago. And I was walking around NYU's campus. Like, I hadn't even gotten into grad school. I talked my way past the guards and was like, went to the film school there and was looking for somebody that could transfer the tapes to a more stable format, to DVD, for like $100 or $50 or whatever. And there's this one guy who's like, you know, what you got, man? And he popped in one of the things and he saw what he had and he called his boss. He was like, you got to take a look at this. And, you know, you're absolutely right. There was not a lot of footage available then. It was just a very, very rare thing. But it took them so long, you know, the producers, to raise the money to do it that it didn't get released until, you know, 2010. But at the time, you know, it was, oh, my God, you know, this is the only – one of the very few stories that exists, you know, on video of the initial invasion. And, you know, and then, you know, now, like you said, there's GoPros everywhere. So it's but it's cool because it shows that initial invasion, and there's not a lot that shows that in the way that this done, which is the entire process of, you know, pre-war and then ending with coming home from the war. So
now, sorry, Mike, this Toby, man, so one of the reasons that, like, I'm excited to talk to you is because, like, that moment in time was huge, right? So, like, that's when the American people's thirst for knowledge, you know, with everything that the internet was really just kind of taking this really interesting turning point. Media were getting the ability to do more. In Desert Storm, we had, like, the cool briefings, Colin Powell, like, showing bombs going up, you know, air shafts and stuff. But what we really got in the initial push, in the initial invasion of Iraq, was real-time embeds, raw footage that we'd never really seen before. And, I mean, it's really Ed Burns-type stuff, and it's really exciting. And, like, here you are, this guy, you know, that was like, let me find out if I can take a camera, because you and I were on the exact same page, and you did it. And some great stuff came out of that, not just your footage, but, like, the stories of that initial time. I mean, look at Generation Kill. I mean, like,
sure.
America was gripped. America was gripped by, you know, the small unit dynamic. All of a sudden, you know, yeah, of course, you know, we had, like, Tour of Duty and these great movies like Platoon and, you know, from Vietnam. But, you know, no disrespect to Apocalypse Now, but, you know, casualties of wars and stuff like that. You know, they kind of dove into personality, like an individual personality. They never really dove into the small unit dynamic. And now, sure, all of a sudden, you guys, like with Generation Kill, were able to do that. Severe, clear. I mean, this footage is something that America was thirsting for, and all of a sudden, well, not just America, humanity, I think. You know, the human condition is such a curious thing, and man, it's just so cool. And, like, that's one of the reasons why I'm such a fan of you, is because you took that opportunity, you seized it, and you, like, kicked it right in the junk, really, because you're like, well, this is the way it is. And it's not pretty. And the raw honesty of it, you know, it's something that, you know, I did a film a couple years later, but, you know, I really was aspiring to get that raw honesty, and I don't think I did.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, man. I mean, that means a lot. And it's one of those things, like, something as foreign as a combat as somebody who hasn't served there, you can only tell the truth, right? You can only show what it is, what it's like to be there. And seeing somebody, you know, that's mortally wounded, or, you know, seeing the carnage of war, it's the same for everybody, right? And it doesn't matter what war, or, you know, who's seeing it, what branch of the military, what country, what side you're on. I mean, it's the same for everybody. And I think that's, you know, as storytellers, I think that's what you kind of strive for, is showing people that truth. So, and I think, I don't know, I think certain people just have this desire to, like, show, and it's not reporting, it's like storytelling. You know what I mean? I don't know if that makes sense. It's not
absolutely,
like
no, yeah, no,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, Mike, the and you know, Toby kind of hit on you, and you did too. You know, the carnage, this and that. But the thing is, you also showed the funny part, right? The both the dark humor that we enjoy in the military so much that the rest of the civilian world misses out on. And, you know, like in the movie, you know, you guys messing around on the ship before you even deployed. And then even the stuff when you got into Baghdad and things and you're trying to find the phones, right? And you guys are in a palace or an office or something, Republican Guard office or something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the UN building. That got blown up after the Marines turned it over to the Army and it got blown up, of course. But, yeah, that was the UN building.
Yeah.
So.
And you guys, and one of the guys found a phone. Didn't they find a phone, called back to the States or something like that?
Yeah, some of the engineers, some of the Amtrak crewmen, because the Amtrak guys were that carried our infantry battalion were from, you know, we were active duty and the Amtrak guys were reserves. So they were like college kids with like electrical engineering degrees and stuff. And some of these kids, they figured out how to like do something to the phone line. They got the generators working first, but then they did something with the phone line. So where we could pick up the phone in the UN building in Baghdad and it would ring over to the internal operator in the New York City UN building, and we would just ask for an outside line, and we just kept going for like 12 hours, and everybody called home. It was insane. It was insane. Absolutely insane. And talking about the dark humor, there's a funny story that Christian Fraga was the editor and he was the director, you know, of the film, and you know, I worked very, very closely on it for 5 years, 4 or 5 years in the writing and doing the voiceovers and, you know, just the kind of the storytelling aspect of it. And I had footage. You know, and I hope I don't take heat for this. It's, you know, it is what it is. But it, I had footage of a young Marine who had found a dead squirrel in the parking lot of our unit's office. This is at Camp Pendleton. And he skinned a squirrel and then, like, strung it up like a marionette and was walking through the office in the parking lot and making a skinned squirrel, like, salute people. It was awesome. I thought it was funny. And Christian Fraga was mortified. And he was like, no, we can't put that in there. I was like, well, that's funny. But he didn't think it was funny.
Yeah.
So
some people, and that's why it's sometimes good to have the yin to the yang, right? Everyone in the military, which probably was just some smaller percentage of who saw the film, would have loved it, and the press and everyone else probably would have not really liked it. You would have had PETA breathing down your throat like you're the one who killed it or something. You know, but
So
you kind of went from that. I mean, that was that gave you a good jumping point, and you got a lot of press and visibility and credibility in the industry making that great film, which, you know, and Toby brought up Generation Kill, which, you know, they were actually, if I remember right, they actually, you got some of them in your footage, that unit that was.
And Nate, good friend of mine. Nate Fick is a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
Nate Fick and I, and that's the lieutenant, you know, who was featured. It was his platoon that was the crux of it, the whole thing. Because Evan Wright, the writer from Rolling Stone who wrote the book Generation Kill, was actually in Nate Fick's vehicle, and Nate and I were in 1st Battalion, 1st Marines together in Afghanistan in 2001, and we went on that deployment together. So he was in Alpha Company, I was in Charlie Company, but it was like crazy. And a funny story, not funny, but like an interesting story was when I read Generation Kill, and then I saw the miniseries on HBO, and I won't ruin it for people. You know, but there's a scene where there's a shooting at a checkpoint, and it's a civilian, you know, it's a civilian vehicle that's hit, and a little girl is shot in the head. That's the brain that's in Severe Clear. And we drove up on that scene probably a half hour after the whole thing happened. You can still smell the gunpowder. And we're like, okay, what is this orange and white car? We didn't know what that had been attacked at the time. And there's like, you know, carnage and brain matter all over the inside of the back of the car. We're checking it for booby traps because we're going to set up a defensive position there. And it wasn't until years later that I said, wow, that was Nate's guys. And we walked up on that scene, and it was like, that messed me up a little bit. It was crazy. But it was like, I don't know. I mean, those are the things that, they stay with you, right? They stay with you.
Yeah, so. Yeah. The and another little known fact, you know, Toby, you may not even know this, but Severe Clear was previewed on a special screening in Bagram, Afghanistan, on September 11, 2010, hosted by the very own award-winning Boohammer.com. I was actually able to screen that movie in a private screening on Camp Vance, the SF camp on Bagram, in 2010. It was actually, I think I was IMing or texting or whatever to whatever technology we had at the time to Mike saying, hey, man, we're showing it tonight. It was 9/11 in Afghanistan. It wasn't 9/11 here yet. And so we were able to do a screening of it. I was pretty excited. It's one of my most happiest moments here to be able to do that for Mike.
And I appreciate it. That's awesome.
Yeah. And on another thing, so that kind of spun where I was going with this. So that kind of gave you the launching point to then write a book. And you wrote this book, The Blue Cascade, which, you know, I remember when you sent me a copy and I remember when I read it. It was not what I was expecting because it kind of, you took a total different turn on your life and kind of a whole different perspective on your life. And that had nothing, for the most part, had nothing to do with your military service, I guess, is the way I would put it. I don't know if that's the right, if that's how you would, but I mean, it really was, as you say, it's kind of life after war, but I mean, it really was just like, I guess it did, because it was kind of like, okay, now I'm getting into the civilian world, and how the hell did everything I just saw affect that and change my perspective on what's important and not important? Is that a good analysis of it? It's kind of the way I looked
at it. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the way that you know, we structured the book and the editor, you know, he agreed with it. And this guy, Ben Greenberg, was the editor on it. He's amazing. He actually just went to Random House. He just left the publisher that published that book and went to Random House. But it was, I felt like it needed to not just be the war itself or coming home from the war in the very, you know, close aftermath of 18 months or 2 years or whatever, and then just end it there, because, you know, these things have a long tail, and every single person who served, you know, in the war, our lives keep going, and, you know, we can carry these things with us, and there's a burden, or we cannot. They will always be a part of us. They don't necessarily need to define us, but they will always be a part of us. And I was on this rocket ship. You know, I came home and was standing at the edge of a black abyss, and it was, like I said before, it was 04, 05, my dark time. And then all of a sudden I got into grad school, and I tried so hard to get into grad school, and I studied really hard, and it was crazy. It was super competitive and blah, blah, blah. And here I am, I'm not like healed yet, but I got in. And so, okay, now what? Now I go through this insane recruiting process for, you know, the big Wall Street investment banks, and you know, it's a war in itself, and I just, you know, I was like, as soldiers and Marines do, just totally focused on the mission, aggressive, just sheer aggression, attention to detail, you know, initiative, discipline, like all these things that we learn in uniform that serve us so well on the battlefield, and it they all served me well in that environment, and I got what I wanted until I realized that I didn't want that, and that was like this weird thing, and it was actually the war, the sense of perspective that the war had instilled in me, and the value of time, of a day, a month, you know, a year, versus trying to make a lot of money. And I realized that if you're not happy, you're not happy, and you shouldn't trade your life for time and do something, or I mean, trade your life for money and do something that doesn't make you happy and bring you joy, because life is short, right? So I quit. And I felt like that needed to be in the book to show not only the way that sometimes post-war emotions and anger and things like that don't go so well in the modern workplace, in a corporate environment or whoever, when you've got somebody over you who you don't respect or whatever, and just doesn't understand, but also really showing that the things that are the ugliest also hold the greatest lessons. If that makes sense.
Right.
So.
Yep. Yeah. The And now you've moved on to working on another novel, and you're working on getting that out there. And how's that going?
Well, that took me 3 years. I don't know how to write a novel, so I kind of learned as I went along, and that it's called If I Should Fall. and it's not like any of my other stuff, and that is currently in the hands of editors at the big publishers, and they are reading it and deciding whether or not they want to buy it. And if they buy it, then it gets published, and it's just a waiting game at this point. So my agent, you know, has sent it out, and it's really hard to get a debut novel published, but I'm giving it my best shot, and who knows? There's been, I think, two rejections so far, which is, you know, encouraging, because I thought there'd be any more than that. But we'll see what happens. I mean, it's a total crapshoot. And a novel is different because you have to write the whole thing to try and your agent tries to sell it for you, versus a nonfiction book, which you only have to write, you know, two or three chapters and the outline, and that's what gets sold. But, you know, fiction is a different animal. It's a lot more risky.
Right, because you've got to have the whole... the opening, the climax, the closing, you know, all the characters got to be intertwined, right? You got to carry the story.
Sure.
Yeah. I imagine
exactly.
It's much. Well, that's why the Stephen Kings of the world and Danielle Steeles, I guess, get the multi-$1 million, right? But that sounds like you need to go to Costa Rica more, man. That would probably have fostered more of that.
Yeah, I have to go do research, right?
Yeah. So let me ask you, as all you've been through, you were in Afghanistan on the opening days of that. You were in Iraq on the opening days of that. Written books. You've spoken all over the world. Been on TV everywhere. Yes, we all change as we get older. Even though I still look at you as a young kid. But, yeah, we all change as we get older. But has these experiences changed you, I'm going to say it, politically? Have they changed the way you look at things and what you thought were valuable? Not, I don't say valuable because I definitely have done that. But just... what, how your outlook is on things, or maybe change what you hold dear, or your morals in there through all your experiences, not just combat.
You know, that's a really good question, actually. What I would say is the things that I took away from the war were things like the brotherhood, right, and the truth of you know being willing to lay your life down for those who you love, right, and protecting the country and everything like that. The thing that opened this whole experience has really opened my eyes to is that, you know, there evidence that you think or are being told is hardcore and true. If that's not the case, we have to rely on it. But if that's not the case, it creates a lot of pain. And that was the number one thing that I struggled with after the war was that, you know, I lost friends in the World Trade Center that I went to high school with, Beth Quigley and Peter Apollo. I mean, I knew them. I was in Spanish class with them. Like, I knew them. And they died, like, in the World Trade Center. And that affected me deeply. And I was supposed to get out of the Marine Corps prior to you know, the U.S.'s invasion of Iraq. And I wouldn't have even been caught up in stop loss. Like, I would have gotten out. I would have been done, and that's it. And, you know, who knows with the IRR and all that, and the recall and everything. But I ended up volunteering to go to Iraq in July of 2002. I still have the email. July of 2002. A battalion commander emailed me and said, you know, you have a combat experience from Afghanistan. We'd love for you to join us. Would you extend voluntarily your EAS now so we won't have to worry? I said, of course, sir. And the thing that affected me the most deeply, and I'm not mad at anybody, and I still love our country, and I still would be willing to die for this country, and I'm still proud of what we did over there, but that's the thing that just killed me the most, is that we never found any weapons of mass destruction in the numbers that we thought they were there, because for me, I was there to help them ensure that those weapons of mass destruction would not fall into the hands of the wrong people, so that something, for instance, in New York City, where my brother lives, you know, and a lot of people that I know live, and that's what I was worried about. And that's what crushed me, and that, you know, I was bitter for a while, but, you know, you get older and, you know, you just kind of look at things from a different perspective. Look, America is an amazing country, and things have been polarized, you know, left and right, and, you know, politics here and there, and I try and stay away from it, because I just try not to get involved, just because the whole situation for me becomes confusing and I don't know who to trust. But I do trust the military, right? And I do trust our police forces, and I do trust our the firefighters are out there, and I trust, you know, I have to trust that any future wars and hope will be fought on platforms that aren't, you know, kind of built in quicksand. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
So,
the hey, Mike, I don't mind it. Well, I hope you don't mind. I want to jump in here and talk to you about a couple of things.
Sure.
One, you know, I want to, you know, hit the rewind for a second because, you know, for some reason, I'm always fascinated with the writing process and the change up to the novel and having to, you know, manage it all in your head. You know, how was that for you? Did you enjoy the process at all, or, you know, were you like, oh shit, this is work?
No, I mean, I love to tell stories, and to tell you the truth, I wrote the novel with the subject of what it is because I wanted to get the hell away from Severe Clear and the Blue Cascade. I didn't want to have anything to do with Iraq or Afghanistan, and I just wanted to write something that would entertain people. So I initially, I was kicking around the idea of the, you know, the letter that so many of us have written home to our wives or our girlfriends or our mothers or whatever, saying goodbye, right, in case we should fall on the battlefield. Kind of not supposed to go, doesn't get mailed home, it's not supposed to go out with your own patrol, you know, to be delivered with your personal effects. And I've been kicking that idea of saying the things that you need to say to those you love before it's too late, right, because there's a permanence in things that happen in war. And that was the original kind of lightning rod for the whole novel. And then I really, really enjoyed the process. And it was humbling, and it was a
cool
nightmare. And, you know, we were throwing hand grenades at each other, me and the novel, for 3 years. But it's amazing. And you know, if it goes unpublished, it goes unpublished. But it's been an enlightening and humbling experience. So, for sure.
Well,
for sure.
Rumor has it, you know, like if one of the big publishing houses doesn't pick it up, there's this veteran-owned publishing company called Greybeard Books that would love to talk to you about it.
Sure.
You know, guys like New York Times bestseller, you know, Kelly Krieger, you know, behind that, you know, the founder of Audible.com, Steve Spiro on it. You know, those guys would love to talk to you about that book. If the big guys don't want it, just throwing that
sure
out there, because one of their
and
business
I appreciate
partners
that
is,
very much. Really appreciate that a lot.
Well, I mean, you know, everyone kind of, well, not everyone, but, you know, that's why we started that company, you know, is to, when, the, you know, the big Simon Schuster's and Penguin and Random House don't want to pick up a book that's written with talent, you know, and it gets discounted because of the demographic it comes from, you know, that's why we're there. So love to talk to you about that. But, you know, you're kind of this modern day, like, Hemingway. I mean, we kind of hinted and teased about it earlier, but, you know, we've heard this before about you, and it's kind of interesting life. And, you know, one, I'm jealous on one hand because, you know, you're going to, like, Helsinki, and, I mean, what a juxtaposition, Miami, Helsinki. I imagine, like, the women are equally as good-looking. There's just a perplexion, a slight pigment perplexion difference. But no, like, I think it's awesome. You know, you're getting out there and you're experiencing it. And the reason why I say, you know, a lot of people, you know, are kind of calling you this modern day Hemingway is because you're actually getting out into it. You're going out and experiencing it. It's not because, you know, you've gone to Costa Rica or you've written in the Keys, but, like, you've gone out into the world and you've experienced it. And one of the things, like, that Wall Street experience, I mean, how many guys, you know, has that message resonated with? How many guys have come back, myself included, you know, took a stab at the corporate world and were like, no thanks. I just can't operate within those confines.
Sure.
And now we're, you know, entrepreneurs, veterpreneurs, you know, working in media companies, starting publishing houses like we just talked about. You know, it's something about being out there and doing stuff and, you know, kind of, you know, once you see, like, I know it's again, it's a juxtaposition, but you see, like, the expanse that combat brings into your life, but it also, like, brings everything down and canonizes in this very primal existence. You really can't operate within this limited box. Like, you can't sit in a cubicle and do TPS reports. You know, you have to, like, get out there and do stuff. And
sure.
You're kind of that guy. I mean, you're hostiling it up. I mean, like, who doesn't want to go to youth hostels? I mean, other than the elderly, but, you know, you're Airbnb-ing it up. You're going out there.
Yeah.
You're writing this. You're taking this 3-year writing journey because you want to tell a story and not necessarily provide a legacy to somebody, which is what you did. And, like, you have all of the compliments from me in the world because I think you really provided an amazing legacy with Severe Clear. But, like, this task organized, you know, value of time focus that you're like, this isn't my time. Like, I'm a steward to the clock ticking, and I got to get out there and, like, live and do something productive, you know, like, 3 years to write If I Should Fall. I mean, that's pretty cool. But you're also doing, like, awesome stuff like Reserve Aid. So, like, I'd really like you to tell our audience a little bit about Reserve Aid because I think that's an integral part of what you got going on.
Well, Reserve Aid is, you know, it's a 501c3, full nonprofit charity that a buddy of mine, Lucas Detour, founded back in 2005. And, He's a great guy. He was in the U.S. Army. He's a tank driver. He was in the Secret Service. Now he's a big Wall Street guy, but he's got a huge heart. And I guess I was one of the original five kind of founding, like, board members for the whole thing. And the initial mission was focused on the reserves because they were kind of falling through the cracks, especially in 05, 06, 07, 08, and getting these multiple spun-up deployments, and because they were not tied to any local, you know, specific active duty base, it was you know, weird things were happening. Then we shifted and broadened our charter, you know, as the wars kind of wound down and there was less deployments. So now I think we just hit the $11 million mark that we've raised. But one of the big things that Reserve Aid, yeah, it's been a lot. And our numbers, you know, are such that I think – it's above 95% of what we raise goes directly to the troops. So it's not one of these organizations who, you know, are focused on advertising, focused on usually fundraising, really, and advertising. And then
it's trying, okay, you can say their name.
There's two. I won't say it, but you guys can say it. There's two that I know. I actually discovered another one recently because I tried to get Reserve Aid to help them, and it was Polly Weidenkopf, who's a former E-9 Master Gunnery Sergeant from the Marine Corps who won Marine of the Year for the Marine Corps League. She runs the whole thing for us, and our offices are donated from a hedge fund, you know, lets us operate in their offices for free. And so our costs are very, very low. And I was like, we should help this other organization and partner with them and get this guy a house. And she went through their financials, and she said no. And she's like, they are just like this other organization, and whiskey. No, I'm just kidding.
You can say it because they've already, like, you know, they've already threatened to sue, and we're good to go there. So, like, legally, I can say whatever I want because they're not.
I'm not
going to speak louder than what I do. So.
Yeah. So let's just say that the platform for some organizations is to raise a lot of money, get visibility. But then what they do is they come to organizations like Reserve Aid and say, well, you put in this much money for this. We're going to, you know, kind of get five or six of them together. And I was like all excited. And then Polly was the one. She said, well, why don't they just put the money in themselves? Look how much they have in cash. And I was like, huh. And then she's like, look at their office expenses as opposed to what their program expenses are. Look at the salaries. And I was I never even looked at financials. I just threw some personal connections for this other organization, and it was shocking to me. And so that's one of the proud I'm proud of reserving because the money goes to the troops, and we don't, we're not well known. We don't have a tremendous amount of visibility because we don't do any advertising or anything. And so if there's anybody out there who's listening right now who is struggling financially, if you'd served in Iraq or Afghanistan, and you need help, you know, contact Polly Wydenkoff. It's reserveaid.org, and you can fill out the forms. Like I said, we've helped thousands of veterans, thousands of families, and big and small, whether, you know, it used to be paying the electric bill when somebody was deployed twice and, you know, the spouse left while they're, I mean, these messy situations that we all know happen, to, you know, we just put up a house for somebody in Texas. We bought a guy's dental instruments for dental school because he got in dental school and he couldn't afford the instruments, we bought them for him. So it's a pretty wide, as long as you deserve it, and you're not just looking, you know, you're looking for a hand up, not a handout, Reserve Aid, you know, is definitely a place to take a look at.
So you and I are definitely birds of a feather. You know, I've yoked myself in life with, you know, some amazing guys because, you know, we feel the same way about money. We feel the same way about help. Guys like Chad Robichaux with Mighty Oaks Foundation, Mighty Oaks Warrior Programs, Veteran Outdoors, Cody Hurt and Brad Stripmatter. And same thing, like utilizing companies, you know, that we have access to leverage for our office space and do that stuff and actually help guys and think outside the box. Like, this guy is going to do something really good and he's got talent. He just needs these instruments to get through dental school, do that. And that's a story that's awesome. But, you know, like, that's just a reality. It's a story, but it's also reality. $11 million, bro, is not something to say is, like, unheralded. I mean, that's amazing stuff. $11 million into the community, the veteran community, is more than, you know, I can't do the statistics really fast, but of the five major military veteran service organizations, 11 million in the past year, you know, 5 years, 6 years, well, 10 years, because you said 2005. That's a million a year on target is better than probably 90% of them. And, I mean, that's one of the reasons
I really want you to talk about. Wait, you mean hats don't help people? Don't help people?
Right. No, I mean, just like, there's a lot of small
like,
organizations
I'm,
that,
I'm
that
kidding.
Do great
no, I'm
stuff.
Saying, like hats with logos on them, that doesn't help veterans? I'm just kidding.
Right, right. You know, like, no, you're absolutely, you know, I missed the facetious comment, but no, you're absolutely right. Like, these guys, you know, they're out there, you know, they're jamming money up and they're putting it and, you know, they're building beautiful facilities in Jacksonville, Florida. They're doing amazing stuff for themselves, but
yeah,
on target they're not. And here are these organizations that, like, $11 million. That's $1 million a year on target without ads.
We just got,
without off,
we just,
you know, like, and that's...
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, God
lucky.
Bless you, man. No,
we
I mean,
lucky.
No, that's task organized, time on target, thought process, that's reverse planning, that's everything that you learned in the Marine Corps coming out in a business sense. So you're being a steward, not just to the honor and legacy of what you did, but to what people are giving you. And, I mean, God bless you, man. You're doing good stuff there. And that's what, one of the reasons why I was really excited to talk about it. I mean, I'm excited to talk about If I Should Fall, and I'm excited to talk about Severe Clear. But, you know, everyone that is fans of the show know that, you know, we have a big heart for the veteran space. We have a big heart for the nonprofit. You know, we do what we can here. So, like, I'm really excited for you to talk about it. We're going to put all that information about how people can find out more about you on our Facebook. If you would take a few seconds to say where they can get engaged with y'all, we'd really appreciate it.
Sure. I'm on Facebook, and you can reach my Facebook link through MikeScotti.com, MikeScotti.com. And for Reserve Aid, more importantly, is reserveaid.org, reserveaid.org.
All right, before I cut you off and before we go,
We promised a wild ride. We haven't really given you anything. It's been pretty mundane, a lot of softball pitches. So I'm going to hit you with a quick little liver shot since you spent some time in Afghanistan. What did you think about Bo Bergdahl going and being arraigned this morning at Fort Bragg, no kakalake, on desertion and misbehavior in front of the enemy?
I agree.
Amen. You know, like, I'm super excited. I'm glad that we finally have a general officer that has some cojones. He took them four stars and he traded him for two brass balls, and he's actually doing something. And I'm pretty excited. Everyone knows that we're fans of General Abrams on the show. He's been a guest of the previous show, Top Talk. But no, we're glad things are going. Where are you? Where's your next stop on the Scotty World Tour?
I am in I'm in Miami, Florida now. I'm going to spend Christmas with my folks in Jupiter, Florida, which is maybe 90 miles north of here, and then I'm going to Helsinki, Finland for New Year's and for a couple of weeks afterward to get some writing done there of another project, which we will talk about in the future, that is in the works. It's nonfiction. It's a we'll talk about that another time, and it's very
I imagine
veterans.
Well, I imagine it's probably like, where in the world do you want to find the hottest girls sympathetic to conservative values?
Sir, I am not at liberty to discuss that at this time.
outside of Texas, I don't know where else you're going to go other than Helsinki. But, hey, bro, super grateful that you were able to take the time tonight and come on the show. We're going to cut ourselves loose here because Dave Bray, previous show guest, and in fact our inaugural show guest, lead singer and founder of the band Madison Rising,
cool,
has a new Soldier's Christmas song out, and we promised that we'd give them some airtime tonight and share
awesome
the story that they're out there preaching about our Gold Star families as well as those that are deployed during this holiday season. But I want to give you the opportunity to give a shout out or say anything to anybody for the holiday season.
I want to first off give a shout-out to anybody who is deployed either overseas or who is in CONUS and that cannot be with their families during this holiday season. And I want to give a shout-out to anybody who has ever served in uniform honorably in the United States military, because we are all brothers and we are all sisters. And happy holidays and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Well, while you're enjoying the new year in Helsinki, you know, 5 years ago, I'd have been a little jealous of you. But since then, I've met the most amazing woman, so I'm happy to spend it here in Tejas. But enjoy your time. Make sure everyone you check him out at www.mikescotty.com. And, you know, hopefully we will see if I should fall on the big bookshelves here shortly with a great contract yielding you bukus of dollars. But if not, please go and pick up the Blue Cascade. It's a great book. It's Blue Cascade, a memoir of life after war. And, you know, it's awesome to go check out Severe Clear. You can find all that stuff on our Facebook. You can see it on our Twitter feed, all the links to find out where you can learn more about Mike Scotty. But here is Madison Rising, A Soldier's Christmas, for you, our audience, in honor of all our Gold Star families and all those deployed. God bless you. Heads on a swivel. Merry Christmas. And thank you for keeping our country safe.
Have all fallen back home where I'm from. Thanksgiving's come, Thanksgiving's gone, and my family tells stories round their Christmas tree in the warm living room on Christmas Eve. And the candlelight shimmers as I write down the song, please fall away from family and home as the pen hits the paper. Shadows grow long, but I stay here a soldier. Just me and my gun on this Christmas, I'll tell you the truth in my heart from a place that's forgotten. Time, God, and love, I'll stay here, man. My word and faith, there's nothing in this world that I wouldn't trade to go home.
Come home.